Welcome 1001 fans to another Family Ties special presentation. Our special guest is Ancestry's Juliana Zooks. The title of today's episode is Family Ties, the Hummel Family, From Famine to Feast. Hi, Juliana. It's great to have you with us today.
Hi, John. How are you?
Very good. Thank you. I'm hoping you can give us a little bit of your background since this is the first of our series with you. And give us a little bit about your background and what you do for Ancestry, how you help people find their families, and then we'll get into the subject of today's episode.
Okay. Well, I've been working with Ancestry for 21 years now. I work remotely from my home, and I'm on the PR research team, which means we basically work for internal people. We work for the marketing team, our PR team, and we have opportunities to partner with people like yourself with your podcast and help you out with your research. We're kind of like, you'd call us family history evangelists. We like to, you know, spread the stories that we discover through our research around so that people can just start, get interested and maybe start thinking about researching their own families. You know how rewarding it is as a genealogist.
It's got to be one of the most exciting careers in the world.
I love what I do. It's a new job every day.
Would you be kind enough to share us the story of the Hummels? And as I understand, that's your family. So this is a subject you know extremely well.
The Huggins family was someone, when we rarely get those opportunities to do our own family history, and I work a lot with my mom. She's been doing this since the 70s. And that's when she got me interested, actually. But the Huggins family was, they're an immigrant family. And I started out, I've always been attracted to immigration records and passenger list, because it's such a momentous time in a family's life when they make this decision to leave everything behind in the old country and come to America. And so even though the records from this time period typically aren't really rich in detail, you're going to get a name, you'll get the dates of arrival and when they left, what ship they were on, you'll get the country they were from. Usually you're not going to get a date from this time period or an exact township or anything. Occupation, their age. So there's things that you can use to identify them, but it's tricky to find these records, especially if you're working with Irish people who have typically common names. So what I try to do first is when I'm trying to look for a record or try to even solve any research problem is I put together a timeline. I want to know where these people were when. I was fortunate with this family that they had some children that were born in Ireland and some that were born in the U.S. And using that information and then information from William's death record that said how long he had been in the U.S., I was able to narrow the time frame of when they came. So I was able to do more effective searches for them. So what happened was I found William and Marianne Huggins. These are my third great grandparents. And they arrived on Ashburton on July 29th, 1844. So I was like very excited. Everything matched up with what I knew about the family, except one thing. Where were the children that were born in Ireland?
Yeah.
And so, you know, we think of this in our modern construct, but what we need to remember is that chain migration was a thing back then. A lot of times the families couldn't afford to bring everyone over at once. So the one or both of the parents would go over, get established, raise some money to send for the rest of the family. So presumably these kids were left with family, neighbors, friends in Ireland. And that's an important concept, too. We want to keep in mind that we want to research fully, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. Get to know the people that their friends, associates, and neighbors. Elizabeth Shone Mills has coined the term their fan club. So getting to know their fan club is really helpful in identifying people.
Fan meaning friends, associates, and neighbors, right?
Exactly. That's the acronym. So I went looking for the children. And sure enough, I found them on the ship Liverpool coming over in 1849. So they were age 7, 9, and 11. And when you go through that, knowing the family structure, you know, a lot of people just research that direct line, but having the names of all three of those kids, knowing their ages, that they had been born in Ireland, this, you know, all fit that I had the right family. So this is what our team does is we look for history. We want to look for connections to history because that's where the stories come in. And when we put together the timeline of the parents coming in 1844, the kids in 1849, well, in 1846 is when the Great Famine hits. So as a mom, when I think about this, I get chills every time. Thinking about Marianne and wondering how her kids are doing in Ireland and being helpless because they're unable to bring them over and get them out of this situation. So, and then thinking of these kids crossing the ocean, it's Robert, Judith, and Catherine. Robert's listed as a laborer at age 11.
Wow.
And so, you know, it's kind of jarring to think of that in these, you know, when we think of it in today's terms. But it really did, this record really moves me that, you know, and my ancestor, if we turn their, you know, we turn these dates into ages, we think about it, their parents left 5 years ago. So Catherine, who was my great-great-grandmother, was 2 years old when her parents left for America. Wow. She was going to America to meet her parents that she had no recollection of. And Judith was only 4 when they left, so she would have probably not have very many memories of them either. So this story, it's one that inspires me. And when I think about, you know, when you're in your, you know, 21st century whiny mode and I'm having a really bad day, and that I think about this family and I go, okay, time to toughen up. You got it pretty darn good when you compare your life to what these people went through. So
the parents literally went over first. And why mm-hmm. was there so much time from the time? First of all, why would parents leave a 2-year-old, a 4-year-old, an 11-year-old, number one? And
yeah, you would be only 6 at that time.
And number two, who's taking care of them? And number three, how long did they stay? Where did they go to in the U.S.? And how long did they stay before they could bring the kids across?
Okay, so they came to the U.S. and they went right to Brooklyn and they stayed there. They lived there their entire lives. In fact, these families lived in Brooklyn. My mother was born in Brooklyn. mm-hmm. So they came, they were a lot of Irish. They came, they liked it in Brooklyn and they stayed. But the reasons that they would have left would have been obviously bad, you know, poor opportunities. In Ireland, they were Catholic. So there was a lot of prejudice against Catholic. They would have been staying probably with family. We know there was a Matthew Huggins that was in the area, and he was a sponsor for Catherine on her baptism. So, and I know that they're related. I've actually been able to go back in the Irish Catholic records that we have on Ancestry and take this family back a few generations. And that's one of the other things that I noticed on this passenger list, too, is I just started browsing the list because I'm kind of like a squirrel. I like to go off and explore all these different things. And that's where you find the stories. But I found a Biddy Murtaugh that's listed on there. And I know that William Huggins' mother was a Murtaugh. Now, this Biddy was only 15 years old. So still a little more than a child. But as I'm looking through this passenger list, there are no Huggins. There are no other Murtaughs. But there are familiar names. I'm seeing names of people who were sponsors for them, for kids that were born later in Brooklyn, because I have their baptism records.
Yeah.
So these were people from the same area, and I can compare them to names because I know where they're from in County Westmeath, so I can identify them in Griffith's valuation. And so here we're bringing together multiple records and the clues that we find in these multiple records, and we're starting to see that I can see now that this manifest is actually contains a number of people that are from the same area of County Westmeath. They were all coming together. So they were probably looking out for each other and looking out for these children, which makes me feel a little better.
Absolutely. They had support.
Right.
And this wasn't a safe boat trip, was it?
No, it wasn't. And what was really interesting about it too, and this is another thing about looking at the entire record, looking at it in context. The Liverpool arrived in 1849 in March 9th. So a ship crossing typically took 1 to 2 months at that time. So when you think about that, that means they were crossing the North Atlantic in February and maybe even part of January. So it was a dangerous crossing. It was very cold. And when you think about it, these were people that had just ridden out the famine. They were not in great health. And it took a huge toll. I went through and counted because one of the sponsors was a John Walsh and his brother, Edward. It looks like probably a brother. They were like 2 years apart, but he's listed right above him. And there's a death date listed. He had died in February. And so I started looking and seeing all these death dates on this manifest. So 37 out of the 416 passengers died on this crossing. So that's nearly 9%. And that's actually, that was very common, and actually that's one of the lower numbers. Some of the people that were, the crossings that came into Canada, they weren't as stringent with how many people they could pack in the ship, so the conditions were even worse. There were a lot of people that died. They used to call these the coffin ships. So, and it's, when I look at some of the other stories on this manifest, there was a family, the Tierneys, and there was four of them. There was mom, dad, Francis, who was like eight, and then there was an infant baby that was with them. Mom, dad, and the baby died within days of reaching New York. So all that was left was this eight-year-old little Francis. And I've always wondered what happened to Francis.
When I used your ancestry product, Family Tree, I found it to be one of the most exciting things I've ever done. I was researching my Hagedorn family history. And once you get the correct name in there, it just lights up. And it just, it gives you hints, and then it sends you forward. It's amazing how much you can, every time you get something new and you plug it in, boom, there's a whole new world to explore and to add and to extend that tree with. I found that to be a very exciting and well-made product with a ton of capabilities with regard to how much information they have available. Everybody else's family trees, all the, of course, all of the documentation, all of the censuses, everything. Just amazing how many things it comes from. And now I've got a collection of pictures, and I can see, you know, what DNA traits have been passed down through the family or not, what DNA, what characteristics, that type of thing. And it's really exciting.
Yeah, it is. It's a fantastic time to be doing family history research. When we first started, my mom was pretty hardcore. She's pretty well known in the genealogy community. She's written a lot of books and everything. But in the 70s, when she first started, she actually had a microfilm reader in our basement. And she would go to the local family history center, and she would rent microfilms of the censuses of Brooklyn. And she'd have to sit and troll through, you know, reel after reel of microfilm to find these people. And so she had four daughters, and I was probably about 11. I was about 11 years old at the time when she started doing this. And she would write down a list of surnames, all the surnames she was looking for. And whenever we ran across that surname, we had to fill out a little index card with all the information, and we had to cite our sources. But she'd give us a quarter card for finding the family. So she kind of indoctrinated me into this field that way at an early age. But one of the really cool things about that, because you talked about the family trees and how easy it is. Like, if she'd only waited 30 years, we could find all those census records within an hour, right?
Yeah.
But the thing now, though, the thing that I miss, and I, you know, like I said, I always kind of have that squirrel mentality. I'm kind of like, ooh, there's something shiny over there. Let's see what that's about. And that's how you find the stories. And browsing through the records, getting to know your ancestors' community, and like reading, because when you found a record and it was your people, you savored every little detail on that record, and you were looking paid before and after, you know, were there other family members living nearby them in the census? And so you really got more out of it. So one of the things when I teach classes, sometimes one of the things I try to remind people is it's so easy that we click and we attach these records and click and attach these records. And we're not pulling those details that are clues to our next search, mm-hmm. you know, and finding more stories and more answers. So what I like to do is I'll open up the record in a window, and I'll just I'll start writing all the notes of all the details I see in that record. And then when you go into an ancestry tree, there's a profile page that has a little mini timeline. And I'll take a lot of those details and edit that event on the timeline, like the 1870 census, it'll say it's a residence this year. I'll go in there and edit it and add those details to that timeline. I think I did this when I was working on your tree, mm-hmm. Adding in some details so that now when I'm looking at this, they're, you know, I'm really seeing clues, you know, maybe the in-laws were living with them in 1 year. Where did I find pieces of information? And these are all parts of the story. You really start, and when you extract them all and put them in that timeline, you really see their stories unfolding.
And I know that you, being a professional, you kind of know how the names line up. You'll know that the first male in the family takes on the middle name of.
And, mm-hmm. yeah, sometimes.
Usually takes on the middle name of what, his grandfather or his grandmother.
Yeah, a lot of times it depends on where they were from. The Germans are really well known for this, but they usually the pattern is like the first son is the father, or the father's father, and then first daughter would be the mother or mother's mother, and you go on. And the hazard with that though is you also get, when you have families that are naming all their children the same pattern of names and they're all having kids around the same time, you have these families that look really similar on paper, right? But they may be two distinct families. This may be the cousins over here. So it's real important to, you know, make sure that you, if you have, and I've been searching for Kelly's in Manhattan. And what I do is sometimes I'll build a separate tree to kind of and research both of those families. Because you can build as many trees as you want on Ancestry.
Through a brick, so you hit a Kelly in Manhattan, right?
Right? Oh, my gosh. Just city directories, like a page and a half of just James Kelly. And I'm looking for three generations of James Kelly
or Tom
in Manhattan.
Moore.
Yep, exactly. So, but to do that, I'll just sort them out. Because, for example, with one of my James Kellys, he was born in around 1815 in Ireland. Well, there's another one. Lives in the same ward, born around 1815 in Ireland. They both married a woman named Margaret. So looking at them on paper, they look very similar, but I've started a tree. One of them was James the Baker, and mine was James the Artificial Flower Maker. And so I've started an actual separate tree for James the Baker. So now when I'm running across them and I'm not sure which family I'm looking at, I can compare them to, you know, the record to the two trees and figure out, you know, oh, he was living at this address. This is James the Baker. So sometimes you got to do that. You go to whatever methods you can.
Do you have any interesting stories from your Huggins family? Any of your relatives?
There was, what was the name? There was the cousin that we talked to that gave us the photograph told us it's one of the first families of theater. And if it escapes me right now. But one of the women in that family supposedly was friends with our family, would come and visit every so often. It was old, you know, silent films, even going back that far. But we did have, like you were mentioning with the Becker surname, mm-hmm. we've got a mystery on one of our lines that is very similar. There are two generations of Edwin Brough Dyer, B-R-O-U-G-H, and we have not been able to figure out where that name comes from.
Brough,
I have a feeling.
I haven't heard of that one.
B-R-O-U-G-H. And there are some Bruffs that are associated with theater in New York, because I've been looking into that, because we had a lot of musicians in that family and things like that.
Okay.
So, but trying to figure out, and I have a feeling it's, our brick wall is Eliza Jane Nelson, and I have a feeling maybe that might have been her mother's maiden name, and that was the family's way of honoring. A lot of times when you see those unusual middle names, mm-hmm. that's what it turns out to be.
Right.
Mom's middle name brought in.
Do you have any recent projects or searches that you've done that come to mind that would make great stories for our listeners?
Actually, there was one that we just did. It was a project we worked on in December of last year. And it was, we worked with a filmmaker named Sasha Jenkins. And he's produced a number of other bio documentaries. But we had this concept where we researched the descendants of people who were affiliated with the Underground Railroad in New York City and in Brooklyn. And we gathered these people together, the descendants. We did a lot of descendancy research to find people who had these connections to each other and to the whole abolitionist Underground Railroad movement in New York. And it's really a fascinating time. I bought like 5 books and learned so much about that period of history. That's one of the things I firmly believe in. I think when you dig into a particular place and you start reading the history, you're going to have better luck with your research and better stories. But so anyways, we gathered all these people, not knowing why. We only told them, you're going on a family history adventure. And this was a team project. All of us on our team, and we brought in ancestry progenealogists, and we worked really hard. We identified, I think it was like 50-some descendants. And then we had to go find people that were willing to do this adventure, not knowing where they're going. And as you can imagine, a lot of people were a little skeptical, like, I don't know what this is about, but we had some people came together and said, you know what? This sounds exciting. I want to do this. Mm-hmm. And so we gathered them all and they took a tour of the waterfront in Brooklyn and learned about the abolitionist movement in Brooklyn and some of the abolitionists that were involved. And then ended up at Plymouth Church, which was at that time known as the Grand Central Station of the Underground Railroad in the area. And there was Henry Ward Beecher, a prominent abolitionist, was the minister at the church at that time. And I, for me, it was super, this was my, one of my favorite projects I've ever been involved in, because Edwin Brough Dyer, his two half-sisters were members of Plymouth Church, and one of them was married there.
Oh, wow.
And so I was able to go, because I was there for the shoot, to kind of like fact check. And I was able to be in this place where my ancestors were, and it had this connection, such a great connection to history.
Oh, my gosh.
So we bring these people together, and after their tour, we sit them down in the church, and each of them had received a letter telling their part in the story. And there were tears, and there were, it's a half-hour film that premiered at Sundance, and we've won several, it's won several awards already. But wow. if you or your listeners would like to check it out, just go to ancestry.com/railroadties. It's like all one word, railroad ties.
Okay.
And you can watch the video there. It's really moving. And they, none of them had any idea except one. One of the gentlemen was tied to a very prominent abolitionist and he didn't know why he was coming. But when we stopped at his ancestor's house, he was like,
Now I get it.
Yeah. But the other individuals didn't know. Two of them knew they were related, or three of them knew they were related. They were, you know, relatively close cousins. But there was a third cousin that was descended from the same family, and he didn't know. And there was another gentleman. I'm not going to spoil it because he was in for a real surprise. So it was just a fantastic experience, and watching these people. Seeing the impact that family history and getting that connection to history on their faces and in their words as they are being interviewed about this, just one of the most moving experiences. And they even took us, you'll see, they took us on a tour of the basement of Plymouth Church, and that was where they would bring people on the Underground Railroad and hide them. And it's a dirt floor. It would have been pitch black because they would have been coming in at night usually. But it really was fascinating and learning about these networks that there were actually a couple men. There was a man in New York City named Sidney Howard Gay who actually kept records of the fugitives. And then William Still in Philadelphia also kept records. And the way the network worked a lot of times is William Still was feeding. They were coming into Philadelphia through his office, and then he would feed them in through Sidney Howard Gay's office, and then they would send them upstate. Usually, like after 1850, the fugitive slave law went into effect, and it was no longer safe really anywhere in the U.S., so a lot of them were going in to Canada.
Right.
In fact, Harriet Tubman passed through some of these offices. She was a part of all of this. So just the connections of history and then connecting these real people with these stories that, and they were stories of strength. And one of the things that one of the gentleman that was descended from the abolitionists said that really struck me is that, you know, we see these stories and you see these people and what they did, and you just got to think, we're just not doing enough to help each other. And just was such a moving quote that it was a great experience. I hope you'll get to take a half hour leisure time and check it out, because it really is a great film.
Thank you. I certainly will. That sounds very interesting. There are television shows out there, aren't there, that bring lost relatives together? Have you been involved in any of those?
Yeah, we actually do research for a show called, it's on TLC, called Long Lost Family. And a lot of that is adoptees and biological families reuniting. Bring tissue. You will need Kleenex for sure. Every episode we have in the office, before the shows are sometimes after, we'll do the screenings where we call it lunch and cry. Everybody brings their lunch together and everybody cries together. but we've done Ancestry's done research. We do our pro genealogists do research for Who Do You Think You Are. There are other productions that we're working on that are just we're trying to get off the ground. But we do a lot of times we'll have people from the research team, our PR research team, who you're going to have a few other, but my coworkers aren't from the team on air. But sometimes they'll go on talk shows or newscasts and we'll do these mini reveals to the anchors or the hosts of the shows and teach them a little something. So kind of what we did, we did a little consult with you to, you know, help you through some of your family history research brick walls.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But that's kind of the outreach we do. And so you'll see us on that type of thing as well. And again, we try to be these like ambassadors of family history. And but because a lot of people still think of it as the hobby of that old aunt, spinster aunt, you know, that, you know, hangs out in cemeteries and old libraries.
But I think it's a great hobby for teenagers because they learn so much about history and they also learn about their family.
It is a great thing. And that's how I got inspired by love of history was my mom starting me out. And a lot of the genealogists that do this professionally that I know began at a very, very young age. And it just, you know, you go way back on all these things. And once you get bitten by that bug, it stays with you. You know that.
I do know that. And as a teenager or a young adult, it also can create, it can really strengthen some relationships with living ancestors, with living family, as in a grandfather, a great-grandfather, a great-grandmother, before they pass. And they love to be able to share their stories. And they're really not asked that often to do so.
Right.
So it's kind of neat to be able to do that and to strengthen that relationship.
Yeah, my mom's gone into schools and taught. She actually went into my nephew's school and they were doing a project on family history. And she went back afterwards when they were revealing what they had learned. And some of the kids, that was the message that they came back to her with, was thank you so much. I think one of them came back to her and said, you know, I talked to my grandfather and I felt like I got to know him. And shortly right after that, he died.
Yeah.
And so that connection was made though, before. So it's really an important thing. And there actually have been studies that show, it was Emory University did a study a few years back that showed that children who know something about their ancestry and their ancestors' stories are better equipped to cope with challenges because they have that strength and those roots ground them.
Yes.
In essence. So there is a real benefit to getting young people interested. And we're seeing with the DNA and all this, you know, people wanting to know, get a better sense of who they are. You see these kids. My mom's had all her grandkids tested. And when they got their results, just the excitement. And then all of a sudden now it's like, okay, I need to know more. We've already got one of my nieces that's already into genealogy. So we're passing that torch on.
That's great.
it really is very moving to see these stories unfold. A lot of times you see the similarities. There was one case that was on the show where they were both nurses and they had actually worked together. They knew each other.
Oh, my gosh.
In the same hospital and knew who each other were, and that's my biological mother, that's my biological daughter.
Unreal.
And so you see, you know, a lot of interesting things, and a lot of the cases, I mean, it takes so many cases to get one show to air, but it's more and more possible as our ancestry database now has more than 15 million people tested. So, as more and more people get into the database, the chances of you being able to find that family is greatly increased.
Now, if someone is starting with the DNA, I guess is where most people start, right? The DNA test kit.
Well, not always. Yeah.
Or do they start with the Ancestry product that you have, the search product?
It depends. Older people, I think a lot of times tend to start with, the family history side of things, and then they realize that DNA can be a fantastic tool for researching your family history too. It has the potential to break through one of my mom and my 30, 40 year old brick walls because we found a match that kind of helps us prove a theory we had about the parentage of my third great grandmother. So there are things that DNA can do to help you with your family history. But I really feel like getting people interested through DNA, because people that might not, they might think, oh, it's too hard. I can't do this family history stuff. It's too much work. They don't realize how far the field has come and how much easier it is now. But it's the DNA brings these people in. And the more people we have in, the more collaboration, the more people are going to save those relics, you know, these documents or heirlooms that have come down through their family, like that photograph of Catherine Huggins that my cousin was kind enough to share with us. And so as we come together as a community and start collaborating, and I now, the woman who gave me that picture, I was able to share that immigration story with her. And so it's a give and take that really brings us all together. And now since then, this woman that we met online, has become real part of our family. We went and had dinner with her and her husband when we were in Michigan one time. She in turn has come out and spent some time staying with my mom. So we are now, even though I'm second cousin once removed, but we're true family now. All these branches have come back. So
for the sake of our listeners, could you explain the Irish potato famine? When it happened, how it affected people?
It began in 1846, and the potatoes, the Irish, especially the poor, a lot of them Catholic, there were a lot of Protestant. They were very poor and not doing well in Ireland. They were tenant farmers, so the system just really did not benefit you, especially if you were not wealthy, and if you were Catholic, laws were put in place to keep you not wealthy. Mm-hmm. And so when the potato crop failed, their main means of sustenance, because this was something that they could grow on a small plot of land that they were subletting typically from one of the larger landowners in the area. So when this failed, their main source of food was gone. There were a lot of other things that were being grown, but a lot of that was sold and being shipped out of the country. They set up a lot of kitchens. There was movements. The local communities were coming together. The poorhouses were being completely overrun. They couldn't feed all these people. The church would come in and try to help. In some cases, there were cases where the Protestant churches would set up soup kitchens, but they wanted you to convert to get your soup. So people would convert just to get fed. And so there were a lot. It was a very, very tough time. And year after year, it kept this blight kept coming back. And so up to, I think, 1849 was when the potatoes began coming back. 1850, you start to see this, you know, resurgence of them being able to get this food back. But in the meantime, millions of immigrants fled the country. Millions died in the famine. So it was just a very horrible time. And so I can imagine, my great-great-great-grandparents here probably trying to raise money to send home so that they could maybe buy some food. There really was nothing to be had.
That was a huge step that they took, but one that fortunately the family survived.
Right, and they were strong. And when you think about it, you know, I'm talking in terms of a third great grandfather and a great great grandmother, Catherine Huggins. I actually we connected through our family trees on Ancestry with a second cousin who actually gave us a picture of Catherine. So I now have, it's of course her in a more advanced age, but I have this photograph of her. Now I can see her face and the relationship, the connection to her. She was my grandfather's grandmother. And when his mother died young, he actually lived in her household for a time. And from all accounts, you know, we've talked to this cousin who shared this photograph with us, and she had a little bit more detail on the family history, because my mom had kind of gotten separated from this side of the family a little bit. Her father became ill when she was young, and she was sent to live with her mother's sister. So she didn't know a lot of these people. And in fact, that's what kind of got her interested in family history, is she wanted to learn. She's like, I don't even know my grandparents' names on that side. So we've come together and done this research over the years and found these amazing stories that really inspire, and you know, it just really keeps me going. When you're having a tough day and you think back and you know these stories, you just kind of, I can get through this.
What happened to what happened to your grandmother and her brothers when they reached New York?
Well, one of the daughters, Judith, who came over with them, went out and she worked as a servant for a while. Right after she got here, she was still pretty young. They all just kind of pitched in and helped out around the households and, you know, made it so that the family eventually kind of moved up the stratus. And eventually, in fact, one of Catherine's children was George Dennis, who was my great-grandfather. He became a jeweler, and he married well. He married into a rather wealthy other Irish family that had been here longer. And who they used to sell art. When they first came in the 1820s, they sold artificial flowers. And eventually, they made enough money that they started buying up real estate in Manhattan, up and around, you know, where it had, you know, the north side where it really wasn't populated. Mm-hmm. And this was in the 1850s. And when I started putting that into context, what they were doing was they were buying up city blocks up and around where Central Park was just about to be built.
Yeah.
And then they turned around and sold it for a very tidy profit.
Fantastic.
And yeah, so, you know, they through all these hardships and the trials, these families come together. And there was a difficult time too, though, because my great-great-grandmother on that side died of tuberculosis at very young age. So her children were put in an orphanage in 1850. Oh. So both sides of the family, you're seeing all these stories of hardship, but then triumph at the end. And that led us to the comfortable life that we lead.
Yeah, a lot of people had to put down their lives and pay the price for our generations, didn't they? And that's,
they did.
That always seems to be the story. Mm-hmm. How tough was it for the Irish in New York? And what was happening to them?
It was difficult. There was a lot of prejudice against the Irish. They were poor Papists. They were Catholic. Papists were not looked on fondly at that time. But they came and they settled in their own communities. A lot of my ancestors attended St. Paul's, which was kind of known as the Irish Church in Brooklyn. And so they settled in communities around a lot of the people that came from the same places. And those communities supported each other.
Could you kind of help us out with people who are trying to find their families? Share a little of your knowledge gained about passenger lists and how to look at them and how to glean information from them.
Okay, so my first tip is always to create that timeline to try and narrow down that window of immigration. Ancestry has a huge collection of passenger lists online. We have the passenger list from all the major ports, and now we're starting to go back and catch some of the smaller ones. We also have border crossing records from Canada. One thing that's important to remember is it's during certain periods in time, the British were trying to colonize Canada. So a passage to Canada was cheaper than the United States. So a lot of people made their way to Canada, maybe stayed there for a while and then crossed over. Sometimes they just went there and then came on into the U.S. And we do have incoming passenger lists to Canada too. So you might catch them going from Ireland to Canada, and then from Canada to the U.S. and the border crossings. But there were kind of three eras of immigration, and you're going to find different types of records in these eras. Pre-1820, no laws required the captains to maintain lists. A lot of them did for their own records, but there's no central repository that holds these records. After 1820, the National Archives has a lot of these lists because the U.S. government was now trying to regulate and get a little bit more control. They wanted to know who was coming in and out. What was happening was a lot of the ship captains were bringing in imports from Europe or bringing exports from the U.S. to Europe, but then they would come back on the trip and they had nothing coming this way. Well, there were all these immigrants that wanted to come this way, so they would, you know, kind of redo the ship configuration, put berths in the bottom, and they would start bringing immigrants in. And that about 1820, they started trying to regulate and say, okay, you know, we want to make sure you've got enough food for these people, enough provisions. And so this is when this requirement became, you started having to list the passengers. So there are some pre-1820 passenger lists. They're kind of scattered. Some of them have not survived, but some have. Some of them have been published in different books. So you may be able to find a list that tells you some of the information is typically not very good. names. Sometimes you'll get an occupation and an age. Sometimes you'll get more than that. But there are also collections like, for example, New England Historic Genealogical Society has put together a database called The Great Migration Begins. They're actually books, but we have the database online at Ancestry. So they've taken from their vast repository and they've pulled all these researchers together to put together biographical sketches. And among the pieces of information you'll often find in there is when and where that immigrant came in. And there's other publications too. Scott's to the Carolinas is one of them. So from the 1820s to around the early 1890s is the other era. And these are the lists that are similar to the ones we saw with the Huggins. You're going to get the ship, the captain's name, port of departure, the port of arrival, the dates of arrival, the name of the passenger, age, their occupation, the country of origin, genders are on there. So there's basics. And with family, again, with family structure and with knowing their friends, associates, and neighbors, you can identify your family in these records and find that type of story as well. In the latest era, like from the 1890s to around 1957, which is the latest of the records that we have, you're going to find a ton more information. They started changing the forms because the passenger or the responsibility for these lists was transferred over to the U.S. Office of Immigration. So it started requiring additional information. This was, again, a period where we have these waves of immigrants coming in. You're starting to see the Italians, the Eastern Europeans. A lot of these other ethnic groups that are starting to come to America, and they are, of course, people are going, oh my gosh, we got immigrants coming. We kind of need to keep track of these people. So, but the great news for us is that changes were made to the forms, like in 1893, they were standardized. 1903, 1906, 1907, they began adding each time they would add more information. But you start getting marital status, last residence, and in this case, not just the country, the town of origin. You know, we get birthplaces. Had they been to the U.S. before? And if so, when was that? How long were they here? When? And that you'll see a lot of these immigrants too during this period, beginning in the 1890s, we see what was known as birds of passage. And these were a lot of times the Eastern Europeans, the Italian immigrants, where you see the husband and maybe the older sons coming over, getting seasonal work sometimes in the farms, but finding work, and they would go back and forth. Their families lived in their home in Europe, and they were going back and forth, basically a 6-8 month commute, and then they go back and see their families and come back and work some more. Eventually, a lot of them brought their families here to stay. My Polish great-grandfather, on my dad's side, came over probably, my grandma said about 6 times, but I've only been able to identify 4 passenger lists with him. And my other great-grandfather came over at least 2x that I know of. So he was going back and forth recruiting miners because he worked at a mining camp in Ohio.
Oh, okay.
So, but there's all these details in there. Oh, if you're going to join a relative, who was that relative? And where did they live? Who paid for your passage and how much money do you have? Do you have enough? Because they wanted to make sure these people had enough money to get beyond the port cities to where they were going and that they were able to get themselves established and weren't going to become what they called likely public charge. But they asked a lot of questions. They wanted to know if they were healthy. They wanted to know if they had been in prison or an almshouse or an institution for the same. Were they polygamous? I imagine most of the people responded no to those things because they kind of knew. Yep. I want to get in here. This is probably going to not work well if I say yes. But their ethnic background, and one of the other really great questions that they added was, who is the name and address of your closest relative in the old country? So now you've kind of gotten that lead.
Yeah.
It's European research now, too. So a lot of really cool things that you can learn from the passenger list from that era. But you really kind of want to know, again, you want to know a name, an age of the person, even if it's estimated. And bear in mind, especially if you're looking at Irish, they were really bad with ages. And a lot of times they didn't know. I actually have one ancestor. I got his Civil War pension file, and it actually states in here that he did not know how old he was. So, when they were asked these questions, like every record, you may get a different answer, you want to know that really the key, though, is that estimated date of arrival, using the timeline, and the family structure, knowing the fan club. That's really, those are really big keys to success. The Hungarian one I mentioned coming over, well, his name was Zook, so there were actually quite a few Zooks coming over around that time because it's a very common name in Hungary. But one of the ways I was able to identify him in one of the records was he was coming over with his future brother-in-law.
Oh, okay. Was there a Gadzooks in your family tree?
No. My dad used to love to tell people that, though. He would say, whenever they asked him how to pronounce the name, he'd say, yep, Gadzooks, just like that. And actually, if you go to Hungary, it's pronounced Tich.
Ah.
And I worked in banking for a while, and there was this really nice Hungarian janitor who would come by my desk every day, and he'd tell me, how you say your name? I'd say, Zooks. He said, no, Switch.
Yeah.
And people, so he taught me.
People love to correct pronunciations, whether it's a name of a town or it's whether it's a name of a name. And I've taken it my business to be, in a way, a compliment because they care about the show and they want you to get it right. I think it's less of a I know it and you don't than it is people just trying to say, hey, you know, this is the way it's done.
But, well, with a name like Zooks, you get used to it being mispronounced every so while.
I've got to run them through Google now if it's a name. I just did a story on a Danish folk hero named, his name looks like Per Grutten, mm-hmm. But when you ask Google what's the correct pronunciation for it, it'll tell you Pia Guta. So I would have had it way wrong. So now I've got to kind of check
names. Place names a lot of times too. Place names too, really helpful. That's another, you raise another important point too, though, is sometimes we find our ancestors' names spelled phonetically. Sometimes we'll also find that you've heard the myth that people's families changed their names at Ellis Island. That is a myth. They had people there that spoke the languages that they, you know, so they could communicate with these immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
No one was going out there changing their names. Usually it was the immigrant that would change the name. And in fact, with Zooks, I've seen naturalization records in particular that where they've changed the name from S-Z-U-C-S to S-U-I-C-H, switch.
Huh, okay.
That Hungarian pronunciation. So this is a lot of times naturalization records are a great way to find that original name that they came over with, because sometimes, you know, the name that we've known as the family name all this time is not really the name of that family, you know, that family used in the old country. Mm-hmm. And another tip for them too is if you're researching non-English speaking, remember that they probably were coming over with the ethnic version of their first name. So Google what was Polish for John, or, you know, whatever the name happened to be, or Italian for Joseph. So you want to go in there and find that ethnic version of the name and then search for that, because that's the way they were probably listed. The manifests were actually created at the port of departure most of the time. There are a few exceptions, like early on, some like going into South Carolina, I found some that were created at the arrival. But most of the time, the agents that sold the tickets created the manifest. It came over, and then they went through and checked, you know, who was on the ship and who wasn't. If there's a line through it, it means they didn't make the boat. So they drew a line through it. They weren't on the ship. So a lot of things you can learn. And you'll see little markings on there, too, because as people want to be naturalized, they needed to meet a residency requirement before the final step. They had to be here typically like 5 years, unless sometimes military service and things like that, you know, gave people breaks. But typically 5 years. So to check that requirement, when you're looking at a naturalization record, you're going to find that and the applications they listed, and this is in the later ones, they listed when and where they arrived. Well, then the government would go back and they would check those manifests, and sometimes they'd make notations on there that said, okay, the naturalized certificate number, something, you know, various things. There's a really cool website called Manifest Markings. It's on jewishgen.org, and it talks about all these different marks and what they mean. So even when you start to understand the bureaucracy of all of this, you can find additional clues that'll lead you to even more records.
Yeah, you talk about true family. I think that's maybe the underlying reason that so many of us really have a thrill in trying to put the puzzle together, because all of us are part of a one large human family. And I think that's stressed more and more as you begin to unravel the mysteries of your own ancestry and ancestors and bring the stories together and start to find out a little bit more about yourself. And I'm a part of this family, and I'm a part of a much larger family. A family that's all trying to survive here on Earth and doing the best they can.
And we're a lot more diverse than we think, too. Yeah. I think that's another great thing that comes out of DNA. We find these pieces of our DNA that come from places we never would have maybe never imagined, because some of that DNA is ancient.
Oh, and that's a go ahead.
Our matches, you know, typically when we get to like fourth cousins, or, you know, once we get past fourth cousins, like fifth and greater, it gets a little dicier. You don't share as much DNA. But as far as the ethnicity, we get pieces of the ethnicity that goes way back further than the paper trail, you know, because you're inheriting half of your DNA from mom and half from dad. And they inherited half from their mom and dad. But what you're getting from the grandparents is random. You've got more of grandma's DNA than grandpa's. And so you're this wonderful mix. and even siblings, I compare my results to my sister's and ethnicity, I see different percentages. She has different regions than I have. Like I have Northwestern Europe and the UK, where she doesn't have that, but yet she has a community that I don't have. So there's a lot of, as we bring down all these different pieces of information about our ethnic background, we realize how diverse we really are. And how we really are connected. It teaches us to be more tolerant of other people, you know?
You've done so much family research. Do you really find that the traits are passed along, that a family has an art, a lot of artists, that just keeps coming? Or is that just a rarity?
I've seen that in some cases. I know my grandfather had a love of history. We learned that from his college yearbook. And there are other traits that I've seen passed on. I mentioned that we had a lot of musicians in our family. That trait did not get passed on to me. You do not want to hear me sing. But I do believe there is something to that. I believe that there's traits we inherit by nature. And then there are other traits that we pick up by the people that are surrounding us.
Why do most people, first of all, you and the team that you work with at Ancestry are absolutely the tops in terms of being able to find family histories, and you love working with people. What brings people to you? Do they begin with the Ancestry Family Tree product and then hit a wall and then come to you? Or what brings them to you, and how do they get to you?
So our team technically works for... we're on the PR research team, so we work for our public relations team primarily, but we do also do educational things. We're starting to look at doing more. For example, you're going to be talking to Krista Cowan in another blog post. She does a lot of series of videos on our YouTube channel to help educate people and teach people tricks, teach people about the new products on Ancestry, new enhancements to products that we have, new collections. So we do a lot of that. Sometimes we have an ask@ancestry.com email. Sometimes we'll take questions from that and turn them into blog posts, answer the questions that come in. We also, Krista and I, also monitor our social media pages. We have member services that also go on our Facebook, on our Twitter accounts, and they, you know, when they see these mentions of Ancestry or see when someone posting a question to our page, if it's a research-related question, a lot of times they'll ping us and say, hey, could you help this person out? And we'll try and jump on and see if we can answer some questions and give them some tips. So I think it's the greatest part of my job and why I love it so much. Every day is different. You know, we're doing different things. You know, marketing will come to us and say, oh, we have this idea for, you know, an ad, but we need some research, or we need you to fact check it, or we need this. In other cases, we have the opportunities like the railroad ties to work with this filmmaker. And just there's all these different types of research thing, working on the TV shows. Every single day is different. But a lot of the requests come in from in-house. We work with our content and product teams. They'll, because we use the product so heavily every day, sometimes they'll come to us with an idea. Do you think this is a good idea? Will this work? So there's just, there's a lot of ways people come to us, and we just try to do the best we can to help out everybody and try and spread the word about how fun and engaging family history can be.
Well, I've really enjoyed speaking with you today, Juliana. You're a pleasure to work with, and our conversation I found to be very, very interesting. I know our listeners will, too.
All right. Well, thank you for having me, John. I always enjoy our conversations, and let me know if you need a little bit of help on that brick wall. When I get a little bit of free time, maybe I can see if I can take a crack at it again for you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that very much. We'll be talking to you soon. Thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Grand Canyon University, an affordable private Christian university, is one of the largest and fastest growing universities in the country, offering more than 270 programs online. In addition to federal grants and aid, GCU's online students received nearly $130 million in institutional scholarships in 2022. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu/myoffer to see the scholarships you may qualify for.